Good afternoon, everybody. I wanted to start similarly as on Monday with a story. This one came to mind at the very end on Monday when Renee asked me about this idea of all these internal truths that don't see eye to eye and all these external truths that don't see eye to eye. And then it was further enforced by the poem, the Hafiz poem that she read about dividing the diamond up. So this is a famous story. I bet you a lot of you have heard this before. I say crick, you say crack. So deep breath in. Now, crick. There were once six blind men that lived in a small town in India. And they lived in a shared house where there was someone who kind of helped them out and made sure that everything was okay. And the kingdom that they were a part of had a ruler, a king, a Raja. And this Raj, he one day managed to purchase an elephant, a domesticated elephant. And he kept this in his magnificent gardens. And because he was so proud of this, he wanted to share it. And so he decided to invite anyone of his subjects to come and check out this elephant. Now, they lived in a part of India where there weren't elephants, naturally. And many of the people didn't even know what an elephant is. In particular, these six blind men had no idea what an elephant was, not even that it was an animal. They just had no clue, but everyone was talking about it. It sounded exciting, so they decided it was worth checking out. Having never gone to the gardens before, their little attendant helped them, guide them through the streets until they came to the gardens. And there was a long line of people waiting to check out the elephant. And eventually it was their turn, and they were all very excited. And because it was domesticated, they could just go right up to it and, you know, touch it the way that they would to check it out. But of course, because they were all going at once and the elephant was so large, each one was at a slightly different point. And so each one had a very different experience of the elephant. And so the first one happened to be standing by the tail, and he felt the long, sinewy, kind of hairy piece, and he was like, oh, an elephant is a kind of rope. Got it. It's weird that everyone was so excited about a rope. And the guy next to him was standing next to one of the legs, and he touched the leg, and he was like, oh, it's the trunk of a tree. An elephant is a type of tree. It must be a magnificent tree. And the next guy was standing next to the side of the elephant. He touched it, and it felt like a wall, and he was like, oh, it must be some sort of cool structure that the king had built for him. And the other guy was standing by one of the tusks, and he pointed the end of it, touched the end of it, the point, and was like, oh, it's like a weapon, a spear. And the other guy standing by the trunk thought it must be a snake, a large snake. And the guy standing by the ear, he touched and thought it was like a big leaf. And they all had their experience, and they all concocted their story, their interpretation of what it was. And then they all went and had a little picnic under a tree together. They're all eating together. And they start talking about it. And the one guy's like, oh, man, I can't believe an elephant is a rope. That was kind of a letdown. And the other guy was like, what? Rope? It's totally a spear. It's like some special kind of spear. And the other guy's, no, it's a type of tree. No, it's a building. No, it's a snake. And they're going back and forth, and they start getting more and more heated and arguing. Like, no, it's absolutely, I touched it. I know I was there. Da-da-da-da-da. And in the midst of this exchange, the king happens to be strolling by, and he hears this, and he looks over, and he could tell that these men are blind, and he hears their argument, and he starts to garner what it is that's going on. And so he goes up to them, and he's like, listen, each of you, you got your little experience, and based on that, you concocted a story. And you attach to that story as if that was true. And now, look at you. You're fighting with each other. But if you just drop the story and put your experience with his experience, you might be a little closer to the truth. For those who could hear the king, it was one of those kinds of experiences. Crick. So dividing up the diamond. Of course, that story is often told as like kind of a religious tolerance type thing. That's how I first heard it, right? Like the idea of God or the unnameable, the unknowable, right? That we all have these little experiences and then we concoct these stories and then we go to war with other religions who have different experiences and such, or different stories at least. What I was thinking about talking about today, structure-wise, I thought we would do something kind of similar to on Monday where told a story. I kind of have a couple of thoughts in mind that I want to share that tie into retreat and practice on retreat. And then we'll just take a minute to reflect on a question based on that. And then I'd love to hear from you guys, your experiences with this topic. The topic of how we divide ourselves up, also inspired by some of the things that Renee was talking about, and even what we were talking about on Monday in part two, how we divide our minds up and what that does to us and what that means and how we can work with that better. And again, by all of us sharing our own personal experiences, we have so many more inroads to reflect and to feel for ourselves what that's like and to how to work with that ourselves. And then I figured we'd leave the last chunk of time open to either continue that conversation or just let fly with whatever questions and things are percolating, you know, whatever seems pertinent. So just to start back a little bit, we've been talking the last couple of days at least about different parts of ourselves, right? We were talking on Monday about seeing ourselves as a system and that we're not these unitary beings that we think we are. And then yesterday, of course, Renee was talking about all of the inner conflict and the inner turmoil that's just part of being human and how we often push those away and what it looks like to actually bring those close and to be kind to those, right? And of course, Chula Das has gone into much depth in this in his book and in his teachings about the whole mind system model. And just to lay it out very briefly for those of you who aren't familiar with it, as soon as you start looking at the mind, it becomes very apparent that it is a system and that you have components of your mind, let's call them sub-minds, that are responsible for taking in raw sensory data, processing it, and spitting it into consciousness as an image or a sound or a taste or a smell. And that's also true in our mind, our mental component of our mind, which is has all these different parts that are responsible for different tasks, like doing a math problem or remembering important things or worrying about this specific thing in the future. There's big tasks, there's little tasks, and each one has its priorities, and each one is, you know, there to try to make the being function better and do its thing. Yet each one has a different sense of what that might be. It, at least at points, right? And so inevitably we get into these states of conflict where one part of our mind's like, I think paying attention to the breath is a great idea. Another part of the mind's like, I think that's a horrible idea. Where did you come from, right? And we end up like those six blind men around the tree where we all have this kind of shared experience or at least a shared goal of like, you know, making this being happy. Yet how we come to that becomes a source of conflict. Okay, so that's one piece. And then the other piece as background I want to throw in there is this concept, crucial concept in Buddhism of dukkha, often translated as suffering, but maybe perhaps more subtly translated as unsatisfactoriness. It's that experience of just, I mean, we have it in all the way up to suffering, but all the way down to just like resisting or pushing back or being impatient or, you know, all the little ways that we push back against our experience, resistance, how we resist the moment. And that includes of how we desire for this moment to be different than how it is by getting something or by getting rid of something. So this dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, suffering, I'll probably use those words interchangeably. I'm really interested in how the process of carving up the diamond, which left those suddenly wealthy thieves impoverished, does the same thing to us internally. How by carving up our mind and attaching to different components of it, we end up impoverishing ourselves by giving ourselves a huge reward of dukkha, of suffering, of unsatisfactoriness, and compromising all the joy and the love and the bliss that is our birthright, as Renee was talking about yesterday, that is who we truly are. So first, some examples from my own life, just kind of in the world, and then I want to bring it into the retreat. One experience I had that made this very clear to me was, for many years, I've taught in the classroom as like a school teacher or in different capacities. And so, you know, during the school year, you get into a routine. And as a result, all the different parts of me that had like really clear priorities, they found their place within that routine. There was like, and the way I named it at the time was there was the part of me that was, you know, kind of a recreational part of me. And then there was a part of me that was more about like my spiritual practice. And then there was some other part. And maybe work, yeah, maybe it was a work part of me, right? And each one had a sense, like, okay, these, you know, these times you do this, and these times you do this, and these times you do this. But I had this experience one summer where suddenly school ended, not suddenly, but school ended, and the structure of time management that was imposed externally by that was gone. And what happened was all these different parts that had, you know, kind of a working truce during the school year. Like, okay, I'll take this bit and you take this bit and we're all kind of in balance and no one's totally, totally satisfied. All of a sudden, it was just like, it was just an explosion of internal warfare where, like, there was no more clear external guidelines. So now it was this turf war inside about who was going to take what time. And as soon as this one was taking this time, well, this one was upset about that one taking. And it was just chaos, or as you say, a shit show, right? And it was. And it actually took my house flooding due to a burst pipe. I felt so much better as soon as the house flooded, because suddenly there was just an obvious external priority, and like everything kind of fell into line. It was this amazing experience where suddenly this like seeming disaster just led to me feeling so much more at peace. There's a line from Rumi, actually, a Sufi, a mystic, laughs at sudden disappointment. I always love that. So that was one kind of experience that made it so clear to me how different priorities writ large, each, you know, these are big clusters of subminds with their goals and what they think is valuable and their fundamental assumptions about me and the world and reality, they, when they come into conflict, and just how that tears us apart. Another real world example that made this really clear to me was, we were talking on Monday a bit about these dark night of the soul experiences and these like reorganizations of subminds and how that leads to this experience of turmoil in all these different ways. And as Cynthia mentioned, you know, both losing a loved one, but also giving birth or having a child born, right, causes a lot of reshuffling. So as I also mentioned on Monday briefly, like 3 months or so after my daughter was born, it was just like, yet another shit show. And this one became really interesting because I think what was fundamentally happening was, you know, all my priorities had a shift because now there was this external like need and all these things, you know, had to shift. But the result, it was so, there was this edge of criticism and even hatred that rose up between the different parts of me. Right, so there became this like intense self-criticism, self-hatred, you know, like just self-rejection on all these different levels. Going back to the past of like, why did you make that choice, you know, 10 years ago, all the way to the present. And what was really curious was a lot of this ended up getting directed at my practice, and it was the kind of self-doubt that you brought up yesterday, where it was just like, what's wrong with you? You know, you'll never get this right. Blah, 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 blah. You've been working at this for all these hours, all these years, and blah, 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 blah. And it was a real mess. And it took months for that to kind of settle itself out, probably until the following spring, you know? And this was like December or so. So this segues kind of more even clearly into practice, because self-criticism, I think it's something that we all have to varying degrees, right? But I tend to have a lot of it. And I brought a lot of that to meditation. And it's so absurd when you look back on it and when you look at it in general, because I mean, it still happens, of course, here and there. But it's like the goal here we have of unifying our mind, of bringing things together, of this experience of unity, not just within, but also with everything, right? There's this unification. And to be unified with everything, you know, our mind has to be unified, because to not be unified, we're taking part of our mind, which is our experience of other things, and separating it out, and, you know, we're breaking things apart. Yet the self-criticism is so obviously just deepening the divides internally, right? It's just one part saying to another part, like, you're bad, you're wrong, that's a problem. What you did, bad, bad, really bad. And so the self-criticism is one thing that I've had to deal with a lot in meditation. Another thing, which goes hand in hand with it, is striving. And that connects to expectations. And especially when it comes to something like concentration practice, and when there's these clear-cut stages along the way, right? Or at least the map is clear-cut. For someone like me, that's just kind of a recipe for disaster. Because all of a sudden, there was expectation. And someone who was also kind of driven to succeed at what I was trying to do, right? Was like, oh, I got it stage 10 by the end of the year. And these clear expectations, they just, you know, basically what's happening is here's experience and here's expectation. And as soon as I believe that expectation and I go with it and attach to it, I've carved up the majority of my experience, which is what's actually happening, and this identification with this idea about what should be happening. I mean, this is fundamentally why desire and aversion is the source of dukkha, right? We separate ourselves from what is and what we want to have happen, and we attach to what we want, and so there's conflict, boom, immediately. There's dissatisfaction, there's suffering, there's a feeling of unease, there's a restlessness, there's like an and we all know what that feeling of self-inner conflict is like, right? Whether it's confusion or self-doubt or self-criticism or just, you know, like the turf war I was talking about, we know what it is like in an extreme way. But all of these other things can be very subtle, yet they're still just as much about cutting ourselves up, right? And attaching to certain parts and pitting them against each other. And so striving, self-criticism. And there's another one that's very subtle that I've really kind of tuned into recently for myself. And I say these, I just want to share a bunch of these different ones to kind of illustrate in general, but also to, again, like we did on Monday, to kind of like provide these different inroads, because each person is, you know, a little different and can reflect differently on each one of these components. I also happen to be a very intellectualized person. I draw a lot of, I think as a child, I drew a lot of sense of self-esteem and worth and success by being intellectual and pursuing intellectual things. And as an adult, you know, I see how that's become very much how I feel safe in the world, is if I can concoct a theory, a story, a model, you know, I feel like I'm on top of the situation to some degree. So it's like a crutch in some ways. It is a crutch, not in some ways. And recently, in these really subtle ways, I've been finding how that process of modeling, which is, of course, like with all these things, there's a reason to it, right? They're helpful in a lot of ways. But this experience of having my experience and then creating in my mind a model and then really going to that model, attaching to that model, again, it creates this division internally and this subtle, like, just pulling away from what is, into this like kind of attachment to the thought process and all the modeling. And with all of these things, it's not to say that it's important to have diversity, right? Both externally and in ecosystems and in human society, as well as internally. It's not to say that everything should be like all in the same way, but there's a difference between having a thought and attaching to a thought. There's a difference about having an open-ended idea about how things could be and having the feeling of how things should be. You know, so it's not really the things, the ideas themselves, the models that we concoct. It's how we relate to them, how we attach to them, how we reify and cling to them. And so even in this very subtle way, I find myself just habitually, of course, right, because this is deeply rooted for me, just like pulling against reality, pulling against experience by going towards like analytical processes in the mind and thought processes and modeling and conception and all that. And then the last of these, the last way I wanted to mention of dividing oneself up is what we talked about on Monday, the process of concocting this idea we have of an I, of a separate self, right? And fundamentally what's happening is we have experience, and then our mind takes some configuration of experience. And as we talked about, it changes, right? From like experience to experience, what we identify as the I in that moment. But it takes that part of experience, separates it out from other parts of experiences, right? And so immediately there's a kind of an awkward stance that's just, in some ways, while it's a very natural process that we do it, it isn't, you know, what is, where there is just this experience happening. And so that awkwardness immediately is dukkha, immediately is an element of that refrigerator humming in the background, the unsatisfactoriness, like, yeah. And then to make it even more intense, we deepen that by believing it to be true and then reacting to it and criticizing it or defending it or pushing this away or get, you know, so all of these things just layer upon themselves. And so we have the self, and then we criticize the self, and then we're like, oh man, I shouldn't criticize myself, and then we're criticizing that part of us, and we've got like, you know, a shit show in a matter of a few seconds. So some of the ways that we carve up the diamond, the experience that is each one of us, the node of reality that each one of us are, right? Whether it's by ourself or by criticizing, or one last thought, and then I want to open it up to your guys' thoughts. The hindrances, we talked about the hindrances, opportunities yesterday, right? And so many of those have within them this component of carving up in the sense of like self-doubt, right? We're like questioning what's going on. We're criticizing what's going on. And again, totally helpful, like in all of these things. It's how we relate to that. It's how we go along with that. It's how we attach and divide. And similarly, we talked a little bit about desire and aversion, right? We're separating out what is from what should be, or what is, and we're fighting against it, resisting it. And then we have the thinking, oh yeah, yeah, perseverating about the future or the past, right? The worrying or the remorse. And again, we spend so much of our time, this is also part, another thing that becomes, I don't know, at least for me, became really apparent in meditation. Whenever I would come back from some thought sequence, you know, into meditation, the return, when I allowed it to be, was so pleasant. And there was just suddenly this like, ugh. Because fundamentally, if you think about it, the majority of our being, moment by moment, you know, the majority of our brain and our all of our body is rooted in the now, because it has to be, right? It's functioning, it's running our heartbeat, it's responding to stimulus, it's processing information. It is by its nature in the now. And when we're like contracted around a thought process, it's like we've separated ourselves out. And there's something that's just not all that comfortable about that. Because we're like divided again, right? We're in this thought process, and then the rest of us, this huge part of us, is back there. But the part we're identifying with is like, ugh, over here. So, and that's of course true, whether we're lost in the past or in the future, right? Regretting or worrying or things like that. Those tend to just contract us down into things that aren't now. And then the last thing, because I mentioned coming back to the moment when we allow it to be pleasant, of course, this is that classic conundrum for a meditator where, you know, you've been mind wandering, you come back and it's like, oh damn, I was mind wandering. I sat down to pay attention to my breath. And of course, you know, some of the first instructions we get are like, no, celebrate that time, reinforce the process of coming back to the breath. Yet what we so just inherently, intuitively do is we criticize or we doubt or we worry, or we negate, or we regret. Oh, there was a thought about that. For it. Oh, it's so not coming. Look at how I just divided myself. So we come back to the breath, and it's like, oh, it can be so much more, it's just so much more of a pleasant experience when we allow it to be. And it's, oh, that's a thing. Like we talked about with the hindrances, none of these things are bad in themselves, right? That's one of the other reasons I thought this would be really helpful to talk about. Oh, yeah. Is that a deep part of my mind believed that the way to success was self-criticism, right? That was how I would drive myself forward. A deep part of my mind felt that, was convinced that, knew that striving was the way to achieve, right? So these are all just functioning on these different priorities. And they're not bad, right? It's just about working with these energies skillfully and really seeing, okay, what is my goal? And if my goal is to unify the mind, then committing to something that inherently divides the mind is just ass backwards, you know, full on. And so seeing that helps me with practice. And then of course on the retreat, there's a lot of opportunity to work with this. And another one that comes up a lot for me on retreat is physical pain. Because physical pain, just, you know, when I sit in this position over and over and over and over again, gradually my knees start to hurt, my shoulder and my back, and da-da-da-da. And that's another clear one. You've got the pain, and then we've got the resistance to the pain. And it's such an opportunity on retreat to be with the pain, fully accept the pain, and not divide ourselves against the pain, which is the experience of what's happening right now. And the unification that happens when that, like, moment of acceptance comes is so revealing and so relieving. It's so wonderful, right? It's just such a clear indication of the diamond reuniting, which is really what we're about. So, with that avalanche of concepts, we'll take a minute like we did before, and I just want to like take a minute to just reflect on how it is each one of you have found yourselves, whether out of retreat or today or on retreat in general, dividing yourself, dividing your mind. Because when we see it in others, you know, we can see it in ourselves often so much more clearly. And then we can name it, see it better, and know how to work with it better. So just let's take a moment to sit. We'll do like a minute or two. And just hold the question in your mind and just, you know, see what pops up. See what your unconscious subminds just throw into consciousness and where it takes us. Okay. What emerged?
So, thanks. So, actually, what emerged as a response to the very last thing you said, which is that I've had occasion in this retreat, coincidentally, I'm sure, to explore my relationship with pain. Mm-hmm. This happens every retreat. And I've had retreats where I just made it my business to sort of endure the pain. Like, just the session's got 7 more minutes in it. I'm just going to stay here. I'm not going to move for the next 7 minutes, even though it really hurts. And it's okay. And I'll just, and getting through that can feel really wonderful when the bell rings. It's just like, I did it. I didn't move. I feel really good about this. But I've been trying to do a little bit more what you said just now, this retreat, which is rather than enduring the pain, try to stop resisting it. And I haven't really been able to get, I don't know what the magic formula is for doing that. Everything that I've tried has just felt like, I can sit there, I could be like, okay, the pain is fine. I'm okay with the pain. This is all right. I can be like, well, so that's like right there and it feels this way. And I have yet to figure out how to just be okay with it.
I'd love to open that up actually to anyone, because we've all had a chance, I think, to work with a lot of pain.
I can address that.
You got the mic.
I'm just thinking of an experience that I had on retreat where I had an injury soon before the retreat with my ankle, and it was just miserable. There was no comfortable position at all. In sitting in a chair, you know, I'd have to put my foot up, and then my back would get out of balance, and I couldn't really do the walking very much, and so I didn't have the breaks from the sitting, which made the sitting even worse. So I'm not sure that I have a good answer to your question, but in that case, it was just so awful that something in the mind surrendered after a few days, and the pain was completely present and just as strong, but it didn't hurt. And it was just such an eye-opening experience. You hear that pain is not suffering, but that was the first time I experienced it. And it was just an amazing thing.
Yeah.
It certainly doesn't always happen on retreat anymore, but but at least just knowing that from experience was so valuable.
And that it's possible.
And that it's possible, yeah.
What it looks like.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That actually just reminded me of an experience I had. It happened when I was like 18 or so, and I had my wisdom teeth taken out. And I don't know why, but I decided at that point I wasn't going to take any painkillers. after the surgery. I had this in my mind, this like mind over matter idea. And it was actually a really beautiful experience because, like pain comes in waves, right? And like anything. And whenever it would start getting intense, I don't know why, some instinct, I would just sit down, lay on my bed, and I would just focus on it. And I had this experience then that it was equivalent to that experience that, let's do a little exercise actually together. Let's all say the word pencil just for the next like 30 seconds on repeat. Just everyone just start saying like, if you feel like it, say pencil, 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 pencil. Okay, you guys being good sports. Any of you had that experience where like the concept just broke down to a random jumble of sounds and just this like, and almost, I don't know, this idea of like, how could that collection of noises mean pencil? right? It's like, what is that really? And that was kind of the experience I had with the pain. It was like this moment where the sensations were there, but they just became sensations and no longer identified as like pain. But the question is how to get there. I mean, you mentioned one way, which was the investigating it, right? The exploring it, seeing it for all of the different things, realizing that it isn't a pencil, that it isn't just pain, that it's this, you know, and I feel like with enough time and exploration to really explore something, we can't, like any scientist knows, we have to be as impartial as possible. And the partiality is the resistance, is the judgment. And so getting into the groove over time of exploration at the same time as seeing the sensations coming apart and coming together and blah, blah, blah. At some point, it's like the Matrix. It's like all of a sudden the world just becomes like letters. Or at least the pain does. So that's one idea. Another one, actually, you mentioned that Chula Dasa mentioned to you once about emotional pain, which I found to be really helpful in general, which was this idea of like, okay, what if I had to live with this for the rest of my life? Like this particular pain. I don't know why, but there's just something about that that just like cuts away the resistance, you know? Because it's like, yeah, because you can't resist if you're going to be with it for the rest of your life. You can't, you'll just make yourself miserable. So there's just something about that question that just gives me this, for me personally, it's like you said, the magic formula. More than anything else, I found that to be a really easy access one, personally. Yeah.
Should we pass back?
Another thing that kind of came up for me today, actually, my last sit, was if the mind is not unitary, then it's easy to create separation in that I could observe, in this case, the emotional pain as if I were comforting my most beloved and just sending it tons and tons and tons of love and saying, gosh, I'm so sorry you're suffering. God, I'm here with you. Totally cool. As long as it takes, I love you. It's cool.
We were speaking of great advice from Chula Dasa. Funny how that works. A couple of retreats ago, I had the emotional pain is sort of, I'm more used to that than total terror. I don't know, that seems bigger than emotional pain. And I had an experience that it doesn't need to be elaborated on, but suffice it to say, I was so terrified, I felt like going banging on their door in the middle of the night, which I resisted. And when I did get my meeting with him, he said, and I shared what happened, and I badly paraphrasing probably, but he said, some part of your mind, a subpart, whatever, absolutely believes that's true. And there are an infinite number of other parts of your mind that don't believe that. They don't even know about that. And so now, not saying I don't have, like, even today, good and bad times, but I can, in my head, as a visual, there's that thing that has hijacked me, and it's like watching other little things, which could be like little bubbles or minions or however you like to visualize your brain. They're not, and they sort of, for me, They sort of stand there and start absorbing. They're not, and it's very effective for me to be able to contact other parts that don't know anything about this terror or whatever else it is that's going on.
I'm not sure this is very different than particularly what Jordan was saying or what everyone was saying. However, when I first met Chula Dasa, I was experiencing a lot of chronic pain. I couldn't sit for any length of time, and I was always in pain. And I still have pain, but that was like more. And I was very resistant to it. I was really upset at my body, pissed off. Well, just sad. Eventually, so he gave me advice for just a few minutes, and it helped quite a bit. And then I noticed that when I investigate the pain, like I have this idea, especially if it's a pain that comes regularly, like it's real familiar. And I have this idea, I know what this is, I know what this is like, it's really intense, it's all like, it's big, it's whatever, you know, it's constant. And then when you investigate it, you find out, it's moving around, it's not constant, there's all these different sensations, just like you were saying. And all of a sudden, it just, it's like it just chops the head off of your idea. Mm-hmm. Because that idea that isn't true, actually. It's the what the mind made up. And so that does go a long way in making it less, traumatic or, oh my God, you know. It's like, oh, actually, if I just look at it, it's nothing like what I thought. That'd be a good lesson for relationships.
What you said sparked another idea of how I've dealt with physical pain in the past, because we tend to feel it as very solid. And if you can sort of visualize poking holes in it with investigation, you come to realize that it's not the solid thing that you thought it was. And that, to me, really diminishes it and sort of reveals its impermanent nature.
And another just really handy, in all of these cases, really, I mean, we're talking about pain right now, but of course this is really a microcosm for all of the different ways that we divide and resist and all that stuff, right? So it's just a very concrete and easy, hard one to work with, but it kind of makes you work at it. So it's a blessing in disguise. But Shinzen Young has an awesome little formula, which is always just so useful and pithy, which is suffering equals pain times resistance. So you bring the resistance to zero, and the suffering zero, even if the pain persists, right? It just becomes a sensation. And that's just like a really nice way of encapsulating a lot of what we're saying here. So let's see, we got about 30 minutes left in our little chat. I figure we could go whichever way we all want to go. Like, we could either continue on talking about different ways that we divide ourselves, anything that occurred to you in that time period while we were sitting, just that minute or two, or any questions that arise in response to all of this, or anything that's just, you know, foremost in your mind right now that would be really helpful for you to engage with, you know, with all of us sitting here.
So I've been thinking a lot about the parts of ourselves that we claim and we like. So perhaps, you know, it's a skill that we have or an intellect or a look, you know, something that we identify with that we like to put out in the world that we think of as good and we want people to see us that way. And then also the reverse of that or the opposite of that, the things that we don't like, that either we want to get rid of or push away or are ashamed of or shy away from. And it's helpful to me to look at all of these as processes that were set in place by the causes and conditions in which they arose, all of them. So with that, within that, I see them all as process. So it helped me not to lay claim so much to the ones that I want to push away, but also the ones that I like and want to present to the world. It helps me have a more even field with them or a more even playing ground and being able to see them all in just that way, that they're processes. I don't know if that's helpful to anyone, but that's something that's been coming up in my mind lately in order to get that that perspective, that little bit of a distance and perspective to keep when the emotions really attach to them.
I guess speaking of pain and unification, would you perhaps consider speaking more to purification and what that's like going through?
Actually, I feel like there's probably other people here much more qualified than I to speak about. I mean, I can say a little bit, but I'd love to hear from anyone who wants to talk about
Actually, let me just share one quick thought in response to Jessica, and then let's go into that, because that is a whole big area. One thought, and very similar to what Jessica was saying, that I've also found helpful, because, you know, it's not like these processes go away easily, even if I see that all my self-criticism, striving, and blah, 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 you know, is not helpful. It still is going to do its thing. So, you know, finding these techniques and ways of working with it and gradually weaning myself from, you know, suckling from the beast that is my self-hatred. one of the ways it's helped me, similar to what Jessica said, you know, seeing it all as processes that are arising from causes and conditions, right? One way of looking at it is the impermanent way, right? This is all just shifting, changing. For me, it's like, well, recognizing that all of the causes and conditions that set in place were responding and arising out of all the other causes and conditions. And if you just keep on drawing a line, eventually you just get to the whole universe. And so that fundamentally, you know, I mean, this is the flip side of the no self, right? This is the interconnectedness, that we are each a manifestation of the entirety of the universe as it is. And so to criticize ourselves is to criticize everything. And that takes a lot of, you know, chutzpah. Yet we all have it, but it does. speaking, just a quick thought about purification, then I'd love to throw it out there too. I think as Cynthia pointed out, part of the tricky thing with pain, and especially emotional pain, and especially the kind of emotional pain that arises when it's some deeply buried, very intense, painful thing that's been like, you know, like underground for so long and finally explodes out. Just like with pain, we identify with it, right? We go to it. It sucks us in because it has. I mean, that's how we're wired, right? We are wired to be, you know, like psychologists find that it takes three to seven positive thoughts to have the equal power as one negative thought, right? Because this is survival. Survival isn't about like watching the flower. It's like, oh my God, oh, he's going to eat me. Oh, I'm hungry. Oh, it's cold. I got to do something, right? So it just like sucks us in. And so the process, like Cynthia was talking about, of seeing pain as contextualizing it, right? Stepping back from it and seeing all these other things that are going on. It's so helpful because of that tendency to just collapse in around pain. With a purification and something really intense that comes up, again, it can be so all-consuming and just dominating, right? So some of the helpful things are, again, to quote Shin and Young, but to like divide and conquer, because it's so overwhelming altogether, to like kind of pare it down a little bit. So one way, and I know Chula Das has recommended this too, is, you know, you start to find that it's really hard to work with the mental component sometimes, right? Just because mental stuff is so slippery and sucks us in. But the physical component is available, just like with pain. And we can be with the physical component in the way that we've learned slowly to be with physical pain and just the discomfort and just to tease it apart a little bit and to have a way of being with the experience. Like you were saying the other day, right? To have an open space for it to arise within is really the goal. So that, like Chula Das said yesterday, acceptance can happen, integration can happen, you know? But to see it sometimes is overwhelming all in one chunk. So to go just to the physical at first, and then maybe when it feels a little more manageable to go into the mental. You know, so that's one perspective on working with it. I'd love to open it up. I know your question was a little bit more like, what's that like, right?
Or more perspectives of working with it.
Yeah, well, let's, yeah, people purification. Jessica.
I feel like this is one subject that I've had quite a bit of experience with. Year after year here in this room. So I'll talk about how it came today. Before the retreat even started, I mentally talk about going on retreat, and I invite them because I knew there was one in there that so happened just to kind of show up a couple weeks before I came. So I knew there was something deep down that I didn't know was there that was laying in wait. So I invite it to come. I'm here to listen to you. I make it friendly and that type of thing, wanting it to come up, but not pushing it or anything, just letting it know I'm available. And when it does start to come up, I do kind of go, yes. and just allow it to be there. And then I do go in and feel for the physical component, where it's at. it does change, because sometimes I think it's one thing and then I'll realize that it's connected with some other physical things. And a lot of times for me, I don't get a lot of, it's not always connected to an experience, like a painful thing or something that happened when I was five or something like that. So I just kind of let it be there. If it wants to speak those things, that's fine. If not, I just greet it, like you were saying, greet it with love, the emotional things. And somehow they do keep coming out, though, which is great. But each time it seems like it gets easier and I feel, I don't know, lighter. I hope that was helpful.
I'd actually like to just ask a question about that. When you're in that process, do you use anything to steady yourself? Do you use the breath or anything? Or are you just kind of opening yourself completely and giving your full attention to what's arising?
I stay focused on the breath, and I know that I'm in this room and I know I'm going through that process. But I totally allow it to be there. And I, even today, the I get a lot of visual images. I was seeing them as small, dark jewels, probably because of what Renee brought up yesterday. But like this treasure that was there that got uncovered, and the benefit, the true, true benefit of uncovering that and letting it be there and finding it, even if it is painful, even if it's causing me physical pain in my body, it's just a way that I so want it to be seen. I really want it to be seen. But I do keep present here. Mm-hmm.
Quick follow-up question as well. So, in my last sit, there was two conflicting priorities for me. One priority was when I opened my eyes and saw everyone sitting here, and the Buddha, just the strength was there, and just the sense of connection to everyone here, and there was just such strength to continue. And yet, towards the end, when it was really overcoming me, and I wanted to be able to vocalize and not disturb anybody. So I was thinking, well, gosh, maybe I should be in my trailer. And so it's that kind of balance between, well, I like the support of having people around, but I also want to be able to allow the full expression, whatever's coming, without thinking about the impact of the people in the room. Any thoughts?
So I had the experience, I think, last winter retreat that someone started sobbing next to me. I don't know why or what was going on for them, but what happened to me when that happened was actually really profound feeling of love and you know, solidarity and well-wishing. So I really encourage you to, you know, if, I mean, I don't want you to just like spend every meditation session sobbing, but if something's coming out, it's probably going to help the people around you. It's probably not going to hurt them, so I wouldn't worry about that.
I get that about sobbing, but sometimes I actually have the urge to scream and things like that. Scream, howl, growl, make really weird noises. So that would probably have to go somewhere else. But wish we could just do that in the group. Wouldn't that be awesome? Then you could just be right. Because what happens is you get up and you go out to the woods, or you go into your, put your head under a pillow, and then the urge is gone. And you're like, God damn it, I missed the opportunity to get that out. So, do you know what I'm talking about? All right. But that would probably be a little disruptive if we were all yelling.
I'll just add something that is really, really important when you're undergoing a purification. And those of you that have been through these, you know about this. And those of you for whom it's new, it's an important thing to keep in mind. Never. The thing is, what you're doing is you're confronting whatever it is that you need to purify in yourself from a place of the highest level of mindfulness that you have. So you're totally present. You're not just totally present with the emotion or the memory, the past event, whatever. Because if you get sucked into those, you're just going to relive the past events. It's not going to be a purification. The key thing is you never, ever forget who you are and where you are now. You cannot be mindful and lose track of who you are and where you are now. Even in our daily life, when our mindfulness helps us, we're about to do or say something that we'll regret later. It's that mindfulness of who this person is, the larger relationship, the bigger picture, who I am. That's a behavior that I learned to do when I was an adolescent. I'm not going to do it now, because I'm no longer in that situation. So for a purification to happen, rather than just be to relive some emotional trauma or psychic trauma or tie yourself in a knot about some internal conflict, we do that all the time anyway. And even focusing your attention on it, that can be kind of helpful in a sort of psychoanalytical way, but it's not going to do the kind of purification that we're interested in achieving. The only way that you can achieve this purification is just to be completely open to that which needs to be purified without ever for a moment forgetting who and where you are right now. And that's one of the reasons why it's actually helpful to do it in a room full of other people, right? Because if you could just break down wailing and crying, you probably wouldn't, you might still do the purification, but you'd be at greater risk of just getting lost in the old stuff. So, now, of course, there are limits, and sometimes we do need to take our purification away from the group. when we find ourselves banging our head on the floor and wailing and things like that, even if we're remembering who and where we are, it's only polite to take it somewhere. And yeah, but so, we quite often have a room with several people at once who are going through something. And that's really good. And of course, yes, you're a bit self-conscious about it. But that self-consciousness, if you get caught up in it, it's not going to help you. If you interrupt the process, instead, you're bringing up something else that you need to purify. Because if there's something in you that is blocking you from allowing you to be in a room full of people and quietly sob to yourself, I mean, that's a completely legitimate thing to do. If you've got something keeping you from doing it, that needs to be purified too. But nevertheless, it that self-consciousness that naturally comes from there being a dozen other people in the room is actually quite helpful, because it helps to keep you grounded. It helps you not to forget reality. And then just to consciously remind yourself when it's going is really rough, just, take a moment and say, yeah, but actually, I feel pretty good. This is quite comfortable, temperature's good, that was a great lunch I had. That was going to be a great supper. All right, let's get back to work here. Everything's okay. I can handle this.
So, the first retreat I did with you 2 years ago, I got, a nice flock of sort of low-hanging fruit purification, but since then, really nothing. And I wonder, it'd be nice to think, oh, I'm done now. I don't think that's it. And I'm wondering I always hear stage 4, stage 7. So if you're not at those at the moment, or you're between them, or something like that, and you, do you need to sort of shift things, or will it just happen, or you open it up, or how does one, how might I know other people have this problem too, how might I be unwittingly blocking purifications from coming?
Well, I think the main ways that anybody ever blocks a purification is, there's some people that start out believing, well, you know, I don't have anything to purify. And that's a pretty potent block. But as they sit, those things reveal themselves, and you get past that. But there's something similar, which is you've gone through some purifications in stage 4, and you're gung-ho to reach stage 10. And so, you know, I've done that. So you're in stage 5 or you're stage 6, and some emotional thing starts to come up. And so, you know, I've done my purification. This is just some sort of problem in my meditation, right? So worry a lot less about blocking it and just be open to it. Remain always open. And, you know, when you're feeling any kind of psychological discomfort, that's like a light coming on that says, you know, there's some kind of internal conflict. There's something that needs to be resolved. And you don't need to jump on it. As a matter of fact, you don't want to jump on it. But you want to say, ah, okay, yes, there's something else there. And I'm glad to know there's something else there, and I'm open to it. So you just stay open to it. People will have purifications in stage 5 and 6, and what happens is they go back to being in stage 4 because they don't decide to. It's that whatever needs to be purified comes up as a really strong gross distraction. So there you are. You know? Yeah, and so then you just go ahead and deal with it. But we tend to deal with a lot of the easier stuff early on, the first time we spend a sizable amount of time in stage 4. Then, as you described it well, all the low-hanging fruit, maybe some of the medium-high fruit, you know, whatever it is. But there's stuff that you're just not ready to deal with yet. At some unconscious level, there's too much resistance. And as you mature in the practice, then the shifts, the changes that take place in your mind are going to make you ready. It's going to make those things ready to come up, and then it's going to make the rest of you ready to accept them. I mean, the dynamic that keeps us from dealing with something is partly that the part of our mind that is defined by and engrossed in that is afraid to reveal itself too strongly. And this kind of thing that tends to only come out when there's some sort of external trigger, and then bang, you're in the middle of it, you know. So in meditation, it can take a while before those things, you know, we can kind of personify them. That part of myself feels like it's safe to start coming forward. And the other half of that dynamic is some of the things that we need to purify, it's because that somehow we have a value system that's shared by so much more of ourselves, and it is repelled by this and repels it and rejects it, and it's not ready to accept it. If this thing starts to poke its nose up, you know, it gets pushed back down again. So just recognize that there's those kinds of things. That's the fruit that's higher on the tree, or sometimes it's the things that are more deeply buried, the things that are more insulated. What tends to come out in stage 7 are those things that are really deeply buried. They're the kinds of things that when they do come up, you'll often say to yourself, God, I had forgotten about it. I don't think I've thought about that in 20 years, right? And it's true that, you know, it was really buried deeply. The other kind of thing that comes out, kind of purification that comes out in stage seven, are these things that are so much interwoven into our daily behavior and our daily lives and our, quote, who we are, that they're invisible, that we haven't seen them, you know. It's the I'm a nice guy, I don't want to hurt anybody's feeling, that's really coming from a deep-seated lack of self-esteem, but it has become so much a part of every interaction that we have with everybody that it's invisible. Somebody else might see it, depending on how well it disguises itself. It's like, yeah, he's a really nice guy, but he just doesn't have boundaries, right? Or they might nail it more accurately and say, but you know, he's really lacking self-esteem. He lets people walk all over him. Can't, you know? These are just kind of some examples to let you see. There's one person in particular who's he's a very advanced practitioner, and he had this most amazing purification that happened in stage seven, which is that he realized that he had developed the habit of judging people, and that it was so much a part of his personality, even though externally, you know, you wouldn't know that he's always judging you. But he realized inside himself that he was always in this place of judgment, and he realized that's why he had so many problems with relationships throughout his life. He realized this has been going on every day and in every relationship, in my work relationship and, you know, several romantic relationships and everything else, that I'm locked into this mode of judging people. And then he got to the root of why it was that he felt that some part of him felt like it was necessary to always be in a place of judgment. And we don't need to get into the dynamics of that, but it was something that had been imprinted in him in the way he was raised, in the kind of dynamics of his family and everything had created that tendency, and he'd let that tendency be this subtle disruptive force in his entire life. You know, it wasn't a huge thing, you know, from a storytelling point of view. It wouldn't have made a good story. But it was such a huge thing in terms of the impact it had on his life. So, the things that purify take many, many forms. And stage four and stage seven is when most of them come up. But they will come up. I'll tell you that we are very complex and subtle beings and very deep. And you can be a stream enterer, first path, second path, third path. You still find this stuff there that you didn't, you know, stuff from the past comes up. You know, I've had that happen to myself, and I've been through some great opportunities recently that, you know, help sort of scrub out the nooks and crannies and corners where the accumulated mold and rot is still sitting there.
So Chula Dasa, what you were saying about never forget where you are and who you are, and that'll keep things contained. However, recently, I've had some experiences where it would have been very difficult to stop these things from happening. And it was like, and one time it was screaming, which was different, but but it was like, it was so effective. And then sometimes it's like a real, like a breakdown sob or something, but it's just, it comes and it's just like, I'm here. And you don't have, it's not about knowing what it's from, or, but it's some kind of unprocessed grief or trauma that can come out in different ways. It can come out with movements, you know, different kriyas and things that we're familiar with that. But sometimes it does come out like that. And I think censoring, for me, I've censored that my whole life, and that's why it's still there. So in these times where I didn't, where I allowed myself not to stop it or not to try to contain it or not to try to diminish it or make it less, it passed really quickly, and it was like some huge release happened. And so I don't know, I'm not trying to say you're wrong or something, but I just...
No. Let's clarify here something here.
Because I think sometimes that does happen, and it's just the way it comes out.
Yeah, I don't want you to misinterpret what I say. When I say don't forget who and where you are, that has nothing at all to do with repressing or holding it in or things like that. It, at most, it might, in a peripheral way, and it's not the core of what I meant by it, you might realize that, okay, it would be better for me to slip out of the meditation and go do this somewhere else. Yeah. No, when I say never forget who, when you're undergoing this, and actually this is another good point, very often you will not know the nature of what's being purified. You will only know the emotional flavor of it and the intensity of it. You may never, ever know what it was. Even those things where you know what the initial traumatic incident or the initial set of conflicting values that you observe, even where you know that, you may not consciously be aware of the resolution when it happens. Okay, so that's just kind of a side note. But now, on those times when you let it out, when you just actually go ahead and scream, or, you know, you roll around on the floor and you beat your fists against the floor and things like that, and you let it all out. When you're doing this, I mean, you've been practicing for a long time. You're not forgetting who and where you are. You're not becoming that child or that adolescent or that person from the past.
I wasn't the one who decided it was going to happen and how it was going to happen either.
No. And to the extent that you are divided within yourself, and to the extent that you're looking for an acceptance and integration, there's the part of you, the spiritually mature part of you, that knows this needs to happen, this is a good thing to happen, you're quite willing to let it happen, and then there's that other part of you that it can't help it, and it's just tearing loose. And that's where those two parts of you have the chance to come together and for the integration to occur.
I was slightly afraid the neighbors were going to call the police.
Yeah, I know, we do have to worry about things like that. You know? And these purifications are not all that different than what, you know, the people do workshops. I don't remember what they call it now, but it started out called EST and things like that. Where, scream. What's that?
That's where it's Primal Scream.
Primal Scream, stuff like that. Landmark Forum, yeah. If you were to carefully examine the techniques that they use, a lot of the techniques that they use are actually designed to bring up these kinds of things and to help bring about a certain kind of purification. But we just do it through meditating, and once the mind becomes calm and clear, and as your mind starts to move in the direction of unification, then more of your mind wants this integration to happen, you know, and so it tends to come spontaneously.
I have a question. Do we have time? Or it's the end.
He's in charge today.
Let's take the question, because you were about to ask it a second before.
Do you have that?
Yeah, Nick. Yeah, man.
It's about this the nature of this purification, and whether it has to be traumatic in the psychological sense that is being described, I think, pretty universally here. What's happened with me with introspection is that I have become aware non-traumatically of the motivation behind my action. And then after that, I spontaneously became aware of the particular event far away in my early life that gave rise to this. And I want to make two comments about that, because I feel I have a total understanding of this very destructive behavior, mm-hmm. the root and the reason for it. Mm-hmm. But it's amazing how little power that has in changing the behavior itself. I can watch myself do the same thing over, even though I understand it on all of these levels.
That's right. That's a really good illustration. To understand it intellectually and to be able to put all the links together and things like this, that's helpful. And it often can lead to a real purification of it. But the purification that we're talking about happens at an unconscious level, and the flavor of its occurrence is more of a feeling tone and an emotion. So you can understand why you behave this way. You can trace it back. You can see the patterns of behavior and when they were established and how they've gotten reinforced. And you can say to yourself, well, I don't want to do that anymore. But then something will happen, and it'll act as a trigger, and bam, there you are doing exactly the same thing all over again. And that's because one part of your mind, a rational, intellectual part of it, has put all the pieces together. But that part of your mind that's sitting back there in a compartment that sees its job as recognizing whenever this kind of situation comes up, and whenever this situation comes up, then it launches you into a particular mental state and a particular pattern of behavior. It hasn't gotten the message. It hasn't gotten the message at all. The intellectual understanding can help the rest of you accept it once you come. But what has to happen, you see, what might happen, as an example, what might happen in meditation is that one of the things that these things will come up, and you'll have really clear, vivid memories, and you'll see the connection that's there, and you'll understand it. But you allow yourself to just sit there and be with that and examine the different emotions. Very often you'll find that it's like a palimpsest, that there's this motion on top, but underneath it's something different. And underneath that is the real cause of the behavior, which is something different yet again. You'll just look at it, and these things will present themselves to you. And you really don't want to think about them. You don't want to analyze. You just want to look at them. What's happening? You're allowing these things to rise in consciousness. You're holding them in consciousness. You're focusing your attention on them. That means all these other parts of your mind and the part of your mind that's responsible for that behavior, they're all looking at the same thing at the same time. And you'll just slip into this place where, wow, that's just something that happened. It's not relevant anymore. It's just history. It's just kind of like what date the Declaration of Independence was signed on. It's like that was an important thing, had great confidence, had great consequences. But hey, it's just a historical detail. When that happened, then the next time you're in a situation and that trigger arises, you're not going to react. You might remember that. Wow, yeah. That's I would have usually acted in such a way, but it doesn't happen anymore. That's the kind of resolution that takes place. So I don't want to totally discount the value of analysis in this, because it does have a certain auxiliary role to play. And perhaps, you know, if you can see that an inappropriate behavior that manifests in your life right now has its root in some things that happened in your childhood and adolescence, that makes it easier for you to accept that part of yourself. And that's a really productive thing. But it's not going to do anything about that part of yourself that keeps launching you into that behavior pattern every time the triggers, the button's pushed. For that to happen, there needs to be an integration at a deep unconscious level where that part of your mind changes. It basically, you know, if we could personify it, that part of your mind is looking at all the data that's being presented in consciousness. You know, you see, that part of your mind, which usually launched you into the behavior, and then as soon as it's done so, it went and hid back in its corner, and it never had to face the consequences. The rest of you had to face the consequences. But now that part of your mind is looking and seeing, and so it's going to say to itself, it's going to say, wow, all this time I thought that was helping, and it's really not. It's just making things worse. Gee, maybe I shouldn't do that anymore. Or another way to think of it is it's a kind of a reprogramming. It's this behavioral module that you had that thought it was functioning perfectly, and now new information comes in and says, no, it's not producing the right result at all. It's producing a terrible result. So it reprograms itself and says, okay, let's change a few lines of code and see if we can make this turn out better next time. Yeah. So.
Thank you, everyone.